Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, the Doctrine of Creation, Part 7. For more resources from Dr. Craig, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Now, the final objection to creation out of nothing that I just wanted to say a brief word about has to do with God's relationship to time. Sometimes people will say, well, if God created the universe, if he created time and space, then how could God have existed before the universe if there wasn't any time before the universe? You can't say that God existed before the universe and then brought time and space into being, because before is a temporal relation, and that would therefore be incoherent. So you cannot have creation out of nothing. Well, briefly, I think we've already talked about this problem when we looked at the divine attribute of God's eternity in our section of the class on the attributes of God. And the position that I defended, and I think that is coherent, is to say that God exists timelessly without creation. Or as I like to put it, using the word sans, which means without, S-A-N-S, God is timeless sans creation, and he is temporal since the moment of creation. So God is timeless sans creation, and he is temporal since the moment of creation. That is to say, God existing without the universe exists changelessly and therefore timelessly with a timeless intention to bring a universe into being. The universe comes into being at the first moment of time, and in virtue of his causal relationship with the universe, God enters into time at that moment as well. So that God is temporal. He is in time from the moment of creation on. His creation of the universe is simultaneous with the beginning of time. They occur at the same moment of time. And without the universe, God is simply timeless. And it seems to me that that makes good sense of the relationship between God and the universe. God is not temporally prior to the universe, he is causally prior to the universe, or he is explanatorily prior to the universe, but not temporally prior to the universe. Without the universe, God is simply timeless, and then from the moment of creation on, God is temporal. He is in time in order to sustain relations with the world that he has made. Now, for those of you who are new to the class, by the word temporal, I obviously don't mean temporary. Sometimes people misunderstand the word temporal to mean finite in duration. When I say temporal, I simply mean in time, having a past, present, and future, experiencing the flow of time. So God is timeless without creation and temporal or in time from the moment of creation on. Any questions or comments about that before we move on to the next point on our outline?
I think you've taught us that God is an unembodied mind. So yes. I guess before time, he was just a mind, which I guess he still is, right? But I guess I'm thinking, when I think of a mind, I think of thought processes and thoughts. And then sometimes, at least in my mind, those are in sequence. I think one thing, and then I think another, and then I think another. So how does any kind of sequence of thoughts in God's mind relate to time?
This is a very good question. Tom quite rightly perceives that in our minds, we have what some authors have called a stream of consciousness, don't we? As one thought occurs after another in a kind of stream of ideas. Now, if God is timeless without creation, what would that imply about God's cognitive state? It would imply he doesn't have a stream of consciousness, that he is timeless and unchanging. He has a single, unchanging cognitive state or mental state without the universe. And I think that the doctrine of the Trinity can help us make good sense of this. When you think that all of the three persons of the Trinity are equally omniscient, they each know all the truth there is, there's nothing they can learn that is new because God knows everything, it seems that the persons of the Trinity could enjoy a timeless, changeless love relationship with each other without the universe, in which there would be complete transparency and sharing of knowledge, love, and will. What the Son knows, the Father and the Spirit know. What the Father loves, the Spirit and the Son love. What the Spirit wills, the Father and the Son wills. Just a complete harmony of knowledge, love, and will in a changeless, timeless state. And so I would say that insofar as God exists sans creation, there isn't any need for a sequence of thoughts or a stream of consciousness. There's just a single, changeless, cognitive state that God is in. Yes, Bob has a comment here in the back.
Thank you. Bill, I would have to disagree with the idea that God existed changelessly and timelessly before creation of the universe. I think I've said that before. Because I define
more right into the mic there, Bob.
I define emotion as a change, and we're told that God certainly has emotions. I mean, he's angry, and then he's not angry, and then he forgives, and so on.
Right.
So if you're going to hold to this view that you and also I think that thoughts constitute, you have to have time if you have thoughts, and I think God had thoughts before he had the universe. But if you're going to hold your view, how do you explain emotion then? Would you say God then did not have emotion until after he created the universe? Because emotion, you would have to say, is a change.
Well, if you think of the examples you gave, such as God's anger with sin or his wrath upon mankind or things of that sort, these are in response to changing temporal creatures and circumstances. But I'm only talking about God insofar as he exists sans creation. Once time comes to exist and God enters into relationship with time, certainly then one can imagine God having changing relationships and emotional reactions to people. But insofar as he exists just Father, Son, and Holy Spirit alone, without any universe, I don't see any reason to think he has to be changing in his emotions. There would be just a complete interchange of love between the three members of the Trinity in perfect harmony with each other.
Can you not envision some circumstance in which he could have emotional changes concerning things besides mankind? Wouldn't that be possible?
Yes, although at this point, remember, we're talking sans creation, so there aren't any external circumstances.
Well,
we're talking about God insofar as it's just the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit in perfect union with each one another. And I don't think that thoughts have to involve change. The thought, I am God, I am eternal, I am omnipotent, I am three persons, none of those thoughts take time to think. Those can all be held in a timeless, changeless way.
One more thing, and I don't want to filibuster. I think the way you and I have differences on this, see, I have no idea what an entity such as God, who has unlimited power and unlimited time, would do before he created the universe. I would think that his creation of the universe may be a teeny, perhaps even insignificant thing compared to what he may have done before that. And it seems to me that since we don't know what he did before that, because he's had unlimited time and unlimited power, it's entirely reasonable to think that there are things associated with that period which could arouse emotion, which therefore would be a change.
All right, let me just make one final response to that. We are presupposing here the doctrine of creatio ex nihilo, that there is a point at which God brought every created thing into being. Now, that's perfectly consistent, say, with there being angelic realms prior to the creation of this universe, or maybe other universes that he created prior to this one. But the doctrine of creatio ex nihilo affirms that there is a state of affairs in the actual world which is just God existing alone, and that creation, in whatever form or shape it takes, is not co-eternal with God. That he didn't have to create, it's the free exercise of his will that brings into being something other than God. So I'm asking us to think about what would God be like in that state of affairs which consists of God existing alone without anything else. Let's see, here's Drew has a comment.
Do you believe that God needs to have libertarian free will in order to connect the timeless state of affairs into temporal creation. I've heard some Calvinists argue that libertarian free will is incoherent. I've argued that no theist can ever be a hard compatibilist.
I tend to agree with you, Drew. With respect to God, God must have libertarian freedom. He can't be determined to do everything that he does. And particularly, the Orthodox doctrine of creation, of creatio ex nihilo, is, as I said, that creation is a free decision of God. He brought the universe into being by the exercise of his will, not by some internal compulsion of his nature. That's Neoplatonism. This was a doctrine that the church fathers confronted that came out of Greek philosophy. Neoplatonism was the view that God is a sort of undifferentiated ultimate reality, and that the world flowed out of the being of God with necessity, that the world emanated out of God. And the church fathers rejected any sort of a suggestion that creation is a necessary byproduct of God's being. It's the result of his free will. So God does have libertarian freedom and could have refrained from creation had he chosen to.
Yeah, I feel like the determinist of God sounds more like Spinozian pantheism than any sort of theism.
It is like Spinoza. Spinoza was also one who believed that everything that exists, exists necessarily. That's right. Yes, Gary?
Yeah, points one. On an apologetics program I was listening to, they introduced a concept of meta time that was kind of God's time before time.
Yes.
And I didn't know if that was a conventional concept or if that was just something they threw out.
It's very unconventional, Gary. What it would suggest is maybe there is a kind of hyper time, is the way I have usually heard it put, but meta time would be the same thing, a time above time. Now, what would that be like? How can we make sense of this? Well, let's suppose that this line represents ordinary time, okay? And time begins at the moment at creation at t equals zero, and then it advances up the whiteboard in one moment after another. So this is the history of our universe, beginning at t equals zero, and then it goes on and we're somewhere up there, up the line. Is that clear? That's our ordinary time. Now, what would it be to say that there's a meta time? Well, what it would be is to say that there is another time that exists at right angle to this time, and our time line endures through this hyper time to later time. So hyper time here, letting that be capital letters, T0, T1, T2, T3. Our time itself endures through this hyper time into the future of hyper time, whatever, whether that's finite or infinite. That's the idea, is that there is this kind of second time dimension at right angles or orthogonal, as they would say, to this, and our timeline endures through hypertime. Well, I think you can see this is a metaphysical extravagance which serves no purpose whatsoever, because all the questions will re-arise on the level of hypertime. Is God in hypertime? Or is he timeless? And the whole debate is just replayed again on a second level. So I think that those folks, and I'm thinking here of someone like Hugh Ross, who tries to appeal to a kind of hypertime, are just inventing a sort of fifth wheel that doesn't do any work, and we might as well just stick with ordinary time rather than these sort of metaphysical extravagances. And indeed, if you press Dr. Ross on this issue, he will admit in conversation that his talk of meta-time or hyper-time is just a metaphor. He doesn't really mean that there is a second time dimension. It's just a metaphorical way of talking about a God who exists timelessly and transcends our temporal dimension. Now, you had a second point, I think.
The second question was that if creation started time,
yes,
and as far as the theory goes, creation will end, will time end?
Oh, okay, good question. I don't think time will end once it started. For one thing, creation never will end. What does the Bible say? It says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him will not perish, but what will he have? Everlasting life. He will live forever, for all time. So the promise of the Bible is that God is not going to annihilate creation. Rather, we will live forever in a new heavens and a new earth that will go on forever. So time will never be done away with, even though our physical measures of time in this universe, our clocks, will be done away with as a new heavens and new earth are created. But that new heavens and new earth will still be temporal realities. Yes?
The physical world... does time and the physical world start at the same time? What about spiritual world?
Yes, really
angels,
good question.
You know, were they in time?
I think that you have to say we don't know when God created the angelic realms. It's certainly possible that prior, and I mean this literally, temporally prior to the beginning of the physical universe, that God created these angelic realms. And so that time didn't actually begin at the Big Bang. It began earlier than that when God created angels and other spiritual realities. But when you look at the scriptures, it's just not at all clear when God created these entities. Genesis 1:1 just says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And therefore, simply for the sake of simplicity, I'm assuming that time begins at the moment of the Big Bang with his creation of the space-time universe. But that is just for the sake of simplicity, as you indicate, Bob indicated, it's entirely possible that God could have been active doing things earlier than his creation of this universe. Yes, okay, down here, Donald.
To say that God is in time, then it sounds like he's becoming restricted. Does this put a limit on God?
This is a comment that people very often have, that this is putting a limit on God, that this somehow is restricting God. And I think, frankly, that it's just the opposite, Donald. A God who is changeless and timeless is the one who is restricted because he can't do anything different. He can't change. He can't act or react. A timeless being is frozen like an ice statue in immobility. So in one sense, becoming temporal is liberating. I'm speaking anthropomorphically here, obviously, but I mean, it means God now can act and react. He can have sequential thoughts, changing emotions. He can know what time it is, things of that sort. So I think it's just misconceived to think of God's choosing to enter into relationship with creation as somehow restrictive or limiting. In my opinion, it's not. And even if you do think that it is, well, that would just show that for our sake and our salvation, God is willing to condescend and stoop down to enter our mode of existence in order to have a relationship with us. And in the incarnation, he stoops even lower and takes on our own human nature in order to redeem us.
It seems like that would put something above God.
No, because it's his own free decision. Think of, for example, of his willingness or free decision to create people with free will. That means he's not going to be able to control everything that they do because they have freedom of the will to disobey him and do things against his will. But that doesn't put anything above God. It's up to him whether to create creatures with free will, and he has chosen to do so. And in the same way, I've emphasized that the decision to create a world a reality other than himself is a free decision on God's part that he undertakes. All right, there was some other question.
Bill, on your view, when God exists without creation, you're saying that there was a point at which he decided to create. He was not compelled to create. He didn't have to create. Therefore, don't you have at least two points when God exists without creation, a point when he had not decided to create, and then a point after which he decided to create? So don't you have time, the passage of time and change?
Uh-huh. I don't think so, George. The way I conceive of this is that God's decree to create, even though freely taken, is eternal. It is itself a timeless decision. It is something that God had in his timeless state, a decree to create a world with a beginning. Now, what is required, I think, and is close to what you said, is that even though the intention is timeless, there had to be an exercise of causal power in order to bring the universe into being. But I would say that exercise of causal power is simultaneous with the universe coming into being. When else could it be? It is when he exercises his causal power that the universe springs into existence. And it would simply be technically incorrect to say that there was a time before he exercised his causal power. That is purely a product of human imagination, thinking, say, 1 hour before creation. That's just an imaginary product of our minds, but there really literally isn't any such moment. All right, let's now turn to the subject of continuing creation. You'll recall that continuing creation involved two aspects. First was what was called conservatio in Latin, or conservation. And then the other aspect of continuing creation was concursus, or concurrence. Now, I've already argued that God's conservation of the world in being should not properly be thought of as a type of creation. Otherwise, you get into this weird view that nothing ever endures from one moment to the next, but rather at every moment, God creates a new thing in its place, which would be crazy. It would mean that you're not the same being that came into this room initially, that you haven't endured through time. So we really shouldn't, I think of conservation as God's recreation of things at each successive moment. Rather, you'll recall I gave the following definition of divine conservation. God conserves some entity, E, if and only if God acts upon E to bring about E's existing from a time T until some later time, T star, through every subinterval of that period. God conserves E in being if and only if God acts upon E to bring about E's existing from time T to some later time, T star, through every subinterval of T to T star. So, in this case, conservation is not a type of creation. The object is there, and God acts upon it to preserve it in being until a later time. So it differs from creation in that it does not take place at one moment of time. Rather, it takes place across time as God preserves something in being. And it is not like creation in that it does presuppose a prior subject. In creation, God simply posits the subject in being. But in conservation, God preserves the subject in being from one moment to the next. Now, what biblical data might be appealed to support a doctrine of conservation? Well, surprisingly, I think, The biblical evidence for the doctrine of conservation is, to put it honestly, pretty thin. There really aren't very many passages in the Bible that I can find that support the doctrine that God has to conserve things in being from one moment to the next. And this is initially surprising because modern theologians are so terrified of bumping up against empirical science that they have abandoned the doctrine of creatio ex nihilo largely in favor of a doctrine of conservation. Creation is reinterpreted to mean that God conserves or preserves things in being, not that a finite time ago God brought everything into being. So one theologian, for example, has said that the doctrine of creation is not the doctrine that God lit the fuse that ignited the Big Bang. Well, apart from the metaphor, I think that's exactly what the doctrine of creation is, that God brought the universe into being at some time in the finite past. And therefore, it's odd that the doctrine of creation should be so widely abandoned in favor of conservation when the biblical data for creation is so much more powerful than the biblical data in support of conservation. As I said earlier, the very use of the past tense in the scripture with respect to verbs of creation indicate that an event at some time in the past is in view, not God's conserving the world in being moment by moment. It's almost always in the past tense that God created the world or the things that he created. But nevertheless, let me just mention three passages that could be used to support a doctrine of conservation. First, Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 to 17. Colossians 1, 16 to 17, talking about the person and work of Christ. For in him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities, all things were created, notice the past tense, through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Now, it's that last phrase that could be interpreted to mean conservation. He not only brought all things into being, all things were created through him, but in him all things hold together. Christ is the one who upholds the universe, who conserves it in being. Also, Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3. Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3. Again, speaking of Christ, he reflects the glory of God and bears the very stamp of his nature, upholding the universe by his word of power. And again, it's that last phrase. Christ upholds the universe by his word of power. Notice the present tense there. This is an ongoing activity of upholding the universe by his powerful word. And that could be interpreted to mean conservation of the universe in being from one moment to the next. And finally, Acts chapter 17 and verse 28, which is Paul's famous address on Mars Hill. Acts 17 and verse 28, Paul says, "For in him, that is in God, we live and move and have our being." We have our very being in God. And that might again be interpreted in terms of God's conserving the world in being. So this would be the biblical data, I think, that could motivate a doctrine of conservation, that God is responsible not simply for creating things in the beginning and then leaving them to run on their own devices, but that he upholds or conserves the universe in being moment by moment from that initial moment of creation. Any question or comment about the biblical data concerning conservation of the world in being? Bruce.
The theologians that you referred to who hold to a doctrine of conservation in place of creatio ex nihilo, would that mean that they believe in an eternal universe?
Some of them might. Some of them might say that the universe has always existed, but it is radically dependent upon God because he conserves it in moment, from moment to moment at every moment of its being. So it isn't pantheism, that's clear. This is positing a radical contingency of the universe upon God from moment to moment, but it would just say those moments go back forever. Not all of them would say that, though, Bruce, but I think what they would say is this, that whether the universe began or not is irrelevant to the doctrine of creation. It's just an irrelevant question. Why do they say that? It's because they have collapsed the doctrine of creation to conservation. And it is irrelevant to the doctrine of conservation whether God's conserving activity had a temporal beginning or not. That can have gone on forever. So I've already given a definition then of continuing creation or conservation. I'm not aware of any further problems with that once you get rid of the notion that conservation is a type of creation. So what we'll do next time is look at this second aspect of so-called continuing creation, which is God's concurrence. And this is the doctrine that God causes everything that happens to happen in the world. So that will be the subject next time, Divine Concurrence.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.